Sometimes certain ones among us could. Even then, we were limited, but for the Queen. We no longer possess that ability. We are as trapped in the present as humans.
Why? What happened?
He flinched again.
Stop the car, Michaela. I do not enjoy this. Their wards are many.
I pulled over and killed the engine. When we got out, I looked at him across the roof of the car. So, wards are uncomfortable to you, but that's all? They don't actually keep you out.
Could he enter the bookstore any time he wanted?
Were Baron's wards keeping me safe from any of the Fae?
That is correct.
But I thought you couldn't get into the bookstore. Were you just pretending the night the Shades got in?
We have been discussing She-Seer wards. The magic your people know and the magic Baron's knows are not the same.
His gaze glinted like sharp steel at the mention of my employer.
Come. Give me your hand so I may sift you in. And mind your intent. If you know me inside those walls, you will regret it. Again, Michaela, see the trust I grant you. I permit you to take me inside your She-Seer world, where I am feared and hated, and I go at your mercy. There is no other among my kind who would consider it.
No nulling, I promise. Baron's had yet another edge over the rest of us. Why didn't that surprise me? Was that how he'd managed to conceal the unsealing mirror from me? With deeper, darker magic than She-Seers knew? I couldn't get too bent out of shape over it, however, because it meant I really was safe in the bookstore. How complex I was becoming. Grateful for power wherever it could be found, provided it worked for me. Are we clear on what I'm going to do and what you're not going to do?
As clear as your transparent desires, She-Seer.
Rolling my eyes, I skirted the car and took his hand. At home in Ashford, I have a great group of friends. I don't have a single one in Dublin. The one place I thought I might make friends was at the Abbey, among my own kind. Now, thanks to Rowena, that opportunity was closed to me. She'd been messing up my life since the first night I'd arrived in Ireland, when I'd nearly betrayed myself in a pub to the first Fae I'd ever seen, and, instead of taking me in and teaching me what I was, she told me to go die somewhere else. Then she'd stood passively by while Vlaine had nearly raped me in a museum. Then she'd sent her She-Seers to spy on me, like I wasn't one, too. And finally, she'd added insult to injury, sending them to attack me and take my weapon, forcing me to harm one of my own. Not once had Rowena welcomed me. Not once had she shown me anything but disdain and distrust, for no good reason. These women were never going to forgive me for killing one of them. I knew that, and I wasn't here to ask them to. It's not the hand you're dealt that matters. It's how you play the cards. I was here to set the record straight. Rowena had made a statement this afternoon. By sending her She-Seers after me in force, with orders to subdue me and steal my weapon, she had said, "You are not one of us, and the only way you can become one of us is complete subjugation to my will. Give me your weapon, obey me in all things, and I'll consider letting you into the fold." I was here to make my own statement back. Screw you, old woman. To drive my point home, I'd brought as my protector a Fae prince capable of destroying them all. Not that I would ever let him. If she was a wise woman, she wouldn't mess with me again, and she'd call off her attack dogs. I already had enough people and monsters messing with me. Darn it all, I'd wanted friends, and I'd wanted them among my own kind. I'd wanted girls like Danny, only older, to confide in, to talk to share secrets of our heritage with. I wanted to belong here. I'd wanted to learn about the O'Connors, the bloodline I was supposedly descended from, and the last living member of. "Take me in," I told Vlaine, bracing myself to be sifted. I asked Vlaine why the Fae call it sifting, and he said it was the only human word that encapsulated the basics of what they do. The Fae sift the limitless dimensions like grains of sand through their fingers, letting a little spill here, a little spill there, sorting them until they have hold of the ones they want. When they have chosen, things change. I asked if that meant he chose the grain of place where he wanted to be and moved there by the power of thought. He didn't get the idea of moving there. According to him, neither we nor the dimensions moved. We simply changed. And there it was again, the two prevalent Fey concepts, stasis or change. Sifting felt like dying. I simply stopped existing completely. Then was there again. It was painless, but deeply disturbing. One moment I was outside, standing next to the viper in near darkness. The next, my night-enlarged pupils gorged on a blaze of lights, momentarily blinding me, and when I could see again, I was inside the brilliantly lit walls of Arlington Abbey. Women were screaming, many and loudly. It was deafening. For a moment I was afraid they were under attack. Then I understood. I was the attack. I was hearing the sound of hundreds of she-seers sensing an immensely powerful fey inside their warded walls. I'd forgotten about that tiny detail. Of course they would sense Blaine, and they'd raise the hue and cry.
"Shall I shut them up?"
Blaine said. "No, leave them alone. They'll stop in a minute," I hoped. They did. At my direction, he'd sifted us into the rear of the abbey, where I'd hoped to find the dormitories. My guess, based on the sketches I'd seen online, had been accurate. One by one, doors opened, heads popped out, mouths closed, gaped, and closed again. A familiar head of curly red hair emerged from a nearby room.
"Oh, you are so feckin' dead!" Danny exclaimed. "You were in serious trouble before, but now she's going to kill you."
"Watch your language, Danny," chastised the woman who appeared in the doorway behind her. Danny rolled her eyes. "I'd like to see her try," I said. The outer corners of the gammon redhead's mouth twitched.
"How dare you come here? How dare you bring that thing in here?"
demanded a pajama-clad she-seer, stabbing a finger at Blaine. Another head popped into view behind her, nose heavily bandaged. I knew that woman. My fist had met her face earlier today. Her eyes were bloodshot from crying and narrowed on me with hostility. When he stiffened, I placed a hand on his arm, careful to harbor no nulling intent, in a show of solidarity I hoped would diffuse his aggression. The corridor was now filled with she-seers in various stages of undress. Not because of Blaine, but because it was after midnight and I'd woken them. Apparently he was proving true to his word. Not a single she-seer was undressing. I didn't feel the ghost of a sexual tingle. Nonetheless, they were all staring fixedly at him. "I didn't dare come here without Prince Blaine." The use of his title pleased him. I felt muscles slide smoother beneath his skin. "Rowena sent six of you after me today."
"I saw the ones that returned," the pajama-clad woman snapped.
She glanced over her shoulder at her bandaged roommate, then back at me, her gaze frigid.
"Those that lived were badly beaten. There's not a scratch on you, not a single bruise."
She paused, then spat.
"Prya." "I am not Prya. You travel with a fey prince. You touch him freely of your own accord. What else could you be?"
"Try a she-seer, who's working with a fey prince in order to help Queen Avil find the she-sadu so she can fix the mess we're all in," I said coolly. "Blaine approached me on the Seelie Queen's behalf, because I can sense the book when it's near. I've been..." She gasped.
"You can sense the she-sadu? Is it near? Have you seen it?"
She-seers up and down the corridor turned to each other, exclaiming. "Can't any of you sense it?" I glanced around. The faces turned toward me reflected astonishment. It mirrored my own. I thought surely there would be others like me. One or two, at least. Danny shook her head.
"The ability to sense fey objects is extremely rare, Mac."
Her roommate said stiffly, "The last she-seer with that ability died a long time ago. We've not been successful at breeding those bloodlines." "Breeding those bloodlines?" The soft Irish lilt didn't soften the words a bit. They were cold. Made me think of white coats and labs and petri dishes. It was no wonder I was so highly sought after. No wonder barons were so determined to keep me alive. And I had a fey prince playing lapdog, and the Lord Master hadn't yet launched a full-scale attack against me. They all needed me alive. I was Tigger. I was the only one.
You killed Moira,
the woman in the door across the hall accused. Blaine regarded me with acute interest.
You killed one of your own?
No, I didn't kill Moira.
I addressed the she-seers, who were all regarding me with open hostility, with the exception of Danny. Rowena killed Moira when she sent her after me to beat me up and take my spear. The woman had a name, Moira. Did she have a sister, too, who was now mourning her like I grieved for Alina? I'm just as horrified by what happened today as you are.
Sure you are,
someone scoffed.
She doesn't even say she's sorry,
another spat.
Just comes in here with her fancy fey guard and blames our leader. I'm surprised she didn't bring a hunter along, too.
I'd give them an apology if they wanted one. I'm sorry I unsheathed my spear and was holding it. I'm even sorrier she decided to lunge for me right then. If she hadn't, she'd be alive.
If you hadn't refused to give us the spear, she would, too,
someone called.
The spear isn't yours,
another woman cried.
Why should you have it? There are only two weapons that kill Fae. More than 700 of us share the sword. You have the other. Do what's right. Give it to those who were born and bred to have it.
Others concurred.
Born and bred, my Petunia, as if I was something less. I'm the only one who can sense the book, and I have to be out there every night hunting for it. Do you have any idea what Dublin's like right now? I wouldn't survive a night without it. Besides, I'm the one who risked my life to steal it.
My accuser sniffed and turned away, folding her arms.
Stealing. Working with a fey prince. Killing one of our sisters. You are not one of us.
I say she is, and she just got off to a bad start,
Danny said.
She didn't have anyone to help her figure things out. How would you guys have done in the same situation? She's just trained to survive, like we all are.
I smiled. I had once asked her the same thing, and she'd acted all snotty and perfect, but apparently she'd gotten my point. I admired her courage, defending me like that. Barely 13 or 14, and she had the balls of a bull. It was also the longest run of sentences I could recall hearing her string together, unplugged by a single cuss word.
Go back to bed, kid,
someone called.
I am not a feckin' kid,
Danny bristled.
I've killed more of them than any of you.
What's your kill count now, Danny? Last time we talked, she'd had 47 unseelie kills to her credit. With her she-gift of heightened speed, armed with the Seelie Haller, the Sword of Light, she had to be a formidable fighter. I'd like the chance to find out one day, to battle at her side. The two of us could seriously watch each other's backs.
92, she said proudly. And I just got this big, nasty fecker with dozens of mouths and a huge, disgusting dick.
All right, Danny, that's it,
her roommate said sharply, forcibly turning her from the door.
Back to bed.
You got the many-mouthed thing? I exclaimed.
Way to go, Danny.
Thanks,
she said proudly.
He was tough to kill. You wouldn't believe.
Bed. Now.
Her roommate shoved Danny into the room and pulled the door shut behind her, remaining in the hall. You know she's just standing on the other side of the door listening, I said. What's the point?
Stay out of our business and get that thing out of here.
Well said,
came the voice of steel I'd been waiting for. She-seers fell back, allowing a silver-haired woman through. I'd wondered how long it would take her to get here. I'd wagered 2 or 3 minutes. It had taken her 5. I'd wanted a few minutes alone with the she-seers, unimpeded by Rowena, to clear my name. I'd said what I had to say to her followers. Now I had a few things to say to their leader. I glanced up at Blaine. He returned the look, face impassive, but his eyes were blades, hundreds of sharp, shiny edges that could spill blood in the blink of a lethal eye. With a rustle of her long white robes, the old woman stopped in front of me. Her age was impossible to pinpoint. She might be 60, she might be 80. Her long silvery hair was intricately plaited in a crown above a finely wrinkled face. Glasses rested on a small pointed nose, magnifying the fierce intensity and intelligence in her piercing blue eyes.
"Rowena,"
I said. She was wearing what I guessed must be Grand Mistress garb, a white hooded robe with emerald trim and a misshapen shamrock, the symbol of our order's pledge to see, serve, and protect, emblazoned on the breast.
"How dare you?"
Her voice was low, controlled, and furious.
"Oh, you should talk," I said in the same tight voice.
"I invited you to assume your place among us and waited for you to accept my offer. You didn't. I could only conclude you had turned your back on us."
"I told you I would come, and I was planning to, but a few things came up. Things like being hunted down, abducted, locked up, and tortured to death. It was only a few days."
"It was a week and a half. Days matter now, even hours."
"Had it really been a week and a half? Time flew when you were dying. Did you give them orders to kill me if it was the only way they could get my spear?"
"Ach, it was not I who spilled Cheesier blood today."
"Oh, yes, it was. You sent them after me. You sent six of your women to attack me. I would never have killed any of them, and they know it. They saw it happen. Moira collided with my spear. It was a terrible accident, but it was just that, an accident."
She slipped her glasses from her nose and let them rest on her chest, suspended by a chain of delicate seed pearls behind her neck. Without taking her gaze from my face, Rowena addressed her enclave.
"She is calling murder an accident, she is. Betraying us to our enemies and guiding them past our wards. This woman is our enemy, too."
"I have known where your kind hide for millennia."
Blaine purred.
"Your wards are laughable. They could not prevent a nightmare of me from getting in. You stink of old age and death, human. Shall I weave you dreams of it, haunt you with them?"
Rowena stared past him.
"I do not hear it speaking."
"To me," she said.
"Give me the spear, and I will permit the two of you to live. You will remain here with us. It will leave and never return."
Snow dusted my cheeks. Soft gasps filled the corridor. Some of the She-Seers held out their hands, palms upward, to catch the whirling, icy flakes. I guessed none of them had seen a Fey Prince before. Blaine's voice was even colder than the unnatural snow caused by his displeasure.
"Do you think to kill me with the sword you have hidden in your robes, old woman?"
I groaned inwardly. Great. Now he had both weapons. Should I null him and try to take them back? Rowena reached for the blade. I could have told her not to bother. Blaine raised the sword she sought in a flash of silver and rested the razor-sharp tip in the wrinkled hollow of her throat. The Grand Mistress of the She-Seers went very, very still.
"I know your kind, old woman, and you know mine. I could make you kneel before me. Would you like that? Would you like your lovely little She-Seers to watch you writhe naked in ecstasy before me? Shall I make them all writhe?"
"Stop it, Blaine," I said sharply.
"She did not save you from me,"
he said, reminding me of the time he'd nearly raped me in the museum.
"She stood by and watched you suffer. I merely mean to, how do you say it, return the favor. I will punish her for you. Perhaps then you will forgive me a little."
"I don't want her punished, and it wouldn't be a favor. Stop it."
"She interferes and offends you. I will eliminate her."
"You will not. We have a deal, remember?"
sword poised at a throat, hilt balanced on his palm, he glanced at me.
Indeed, I remember. You are helping me aid your race. For the first time in 7,000 years, they and man are working together for a common cause. It is a rare thing, and necessary if we both wish to survive with our worlds intact.
He looked back at Rowena.
Our combined efforts will accomplish what all your she-seers put together cannot. Do not make me angry, old woman, or I will abandon you to the hell that is coming if Michaela fails to find the Shisadu. Cease trying to steal her weapon from her, and start protecting her. She is the best hope for your race. Kneel.
I didn't care for that best hope for your race stuff. I test poorly. I've never functioned well under pressure. He forced Rowena, white-lipped and shuddering, to her knees. I could see the battle raging within her small, sturdy frame. Her robe trembled, her lips peeled back from her teeth. Stop it, I said again.
In a moment. You will never again come before me bearing weapons, old woman, or I will forego the promises I have made and destroy you. Help her in her quest to help me, and I will let you live.
I sighed. I didn't need to take a look around to realize that I had made no friends here tonight. In fact, I was pretty sure I'd made things worse. Just give her back the sword, Blaine, and get us out of here.
Your wish, my command.
He took my hand and sifted us out. The instant we rematerialized a few dozen yards from the Viper, I slammed him with the palms of both hands, willing him to freeze with every ounce of that foreign place inside my skull. Unlike the first time I'd tried nulling him the night we'd met, he stayed frozen longer than a few heartbeats. I was so surprised that I didn't move myself, until he began to move and I hit him again, putting everything I had into my desire to neutralize Faye. If intention was what counted, I was strong in that department. I'd been intending to grow up one day, for years. I had intentions down pat. I timed it. He stayed frozen for 7 seconds. I searched him quickly for my spear, patting him down, sending little "Stay frozen, you bastard," messages with my palms along the way. No spear. I stepped back and allowed him to unfreeze. We stared at each other across the 10 feet I'd put between us, and I saw many things in his eyes. I saw my death. I saw my reprieve. I saw 1,000 punishments in between, and knew the moment he decided to take no action against me. "It's really hard for you to view me as a valid life form, isn't it?" I said. "What would make you take me more seriously? How many years would I have to live to count as whatever it is you credit as being worthwhile?"
"Longevity is not the defining factor. I do not credit most of my own race as worthwhile, a view born not of arrogance but of eons spent among those who are the worst of fools. Why did you know me, She-seer?"
"Because you majorly screwed up my plan in there."
"Then perhaps the next time you should confide in me the subtler nuances of your plan. I believed you wanted to establish the upper hand, and I endeavored to aid you in achieving that end."
"You made them think I was allied with you. You made them fear me."
"You are allied with me, and they should fear you."
My eyes narrowed. "Why should they fear me?" He smiled, faintly.
"You have barely begun to understand what you are."
Abruptly, he vanished. Then his hand was in the curls at the back of my head, and his tongue was pushing in my mouth, and that hot, dark, frightening thing was piercing my tongue and embedding itself there, and I exploded in a violent orgasm. He was 10 feet away again, and I was sucking air like a fish out of water and floundering as badly. Shock waves of such intense eroticism rocked me that I was momentarily immobilized. If I'd tried to move, I would have collapsed.
"It only works once, Michaela. I must replace my name on your tongue each time you use it. I assumed you did want it back."
Furious, I nodded. Figured he'd not told me about that little catch. He disappeared. This time, he did not reappear. I felt for my spear. It was back. I stood still, waiting for the last of the aftershocks to pass. I wondered if I'd actually succeeded in nulling Blaine tonight, or if he'd been faking it. I was growing increasingly paranoid, wondering if everyone was playing games with me. Surely anything that could move that fast could evade my sophomoric efforts at she-seer magic. Or had I genuinely taken him by surprise? What might he gain by pretending? An ace in the hole? That maybe someday I'd really need to null him, and that would be the day I'd find out it didn't work and never had? I turned around and began walking toward the Viper. I hadn't glanced in its direction since we'd materialized. I did now, and gasped. The wolf Kuntak was parked on the far side of it, deep in the shadows, and Jericho Behrens was leaning back against it, arms crossed over his chest, dressed from head to toe in black, every bit as dark and still as the night. I blinked. He was still there. Hard to peel apart from the darkness, but there.
"What in the... how... where did you come from?"
I sputtered.
"The bookstore."
"Duh." Sometimes his answers made me want to strangle him.
"Did Blaine know you were standing there?"
"I think the two of you were a little too busy to see me."
"What are you doing here?"
"Making sure you didn't need backup. If you'd told me you were taking your fairy little boyfriend, I wouldn't have wasted my time. I resent it when you waste my time, Miss Lane."
He got in his car and drove away. I followed him most of the way back to Dublin. Near the outskirts, he kicked his horses into a gallop I couldn't match, and I lost him. Chapter 6. It was 3:45 when I drove the Viper down the back alley behind the bookstore. The pre-dawn hours between 2 and 4 are the hardest on me. For the past few weeks, I've been waking up every night at 2:17 a.m. on the dot, as if it's my official pre-programmed time slot to have an anxiety attack, and the world will fall apart, even worse than it already is, if I don't pace my bedroom and worry it safe. The bookstore is unbearably quiet then, and it's not hard to imagine that I'm the only person alive in the world. Most of the time I can handle the mess I call my life, but in the butt crack of the night even I get a little depressed. I usually end up sorting through my wardrobe, meager as it is, or paging through fashion magazines, trying not to think. Putting outfits together soothes me. Accessorizing is balm to my soul. If I can't save the world, I sure can make it pretty. But last night, haute couture from 4 different countries couldn't distract me, and I'd ended up snuggled under a blanket on the window seat with a dry volume about the history of the Irish race, including several lengthy pedantic essays about the 5 invasions and the mythic Tuatha De Danann cracked open on my lap, staring out the back window of my bedroom at the sea of rooftops, watching the shades slink and slither out of the corner of my eye. Then my vision had played a trick on me and blacked out the horizon as far as I could see, extinguishing every light, blanketing Dublin in absolute darkness. I'd blinked, trying to dispel the illusion, and finally was able to see lights again, but the illusory blackout had seemed so real that I was afraid it was a premonition of things to come. I pulled the Viper into the garage and parked in its allotted space, too tired to even half-heartedly appreciate the GT parked next to it. When the floor trembled beneath my heel, I stomped my foot and told it to shut up. I opened the door to step out into the alley, flinched, slamming the door shut again, and stood there on the cusp of hyperventilating. The garage where Behrens houses his fabulous car collection is located directly behind the bookstore, across an alley approximately 25 feet wide. Multiple floodlights on the exteriors illuminate a path between the two, affording safe passage from the shades on even the darkest night. Unfortunately, we haven't yet devised a means of perpetual light. Bulbs burn out. Batteries die. Several of the lights on the facade of the garage had outlived their usefulness during the night. Not enough that I'd noticed in the glare of the Viper's headlights and the soft spill coming from the bookstore's rear windows, but enough to have created a sliver of opportunity for a truly enterprising shade, and unfortunately, I had one of those shadowing my doorstep. I was tired, and I'd been sloppy. I should have looked up and checked the spotlights on the building the moment they'd come into view. Thanks to the burnt-out bulbs, a thin line of darkness now ran down the center of the alley, where the light cast by the adjacent buildings failed to meet, and the massive shade that was as obsessed with me as I was with it had managed to pour itself into the crack, creating an inky black wall that soared 3 stories high and extended the entire length of the bookstore, barring me from crossing the alley. I'd opened the door to find it towering over me, a greedy, dark tsunami, waiting to come crashing down and drown me in its lethal embrace. Although I was 99.9% sure it couldn't do that it was trapped in its menacing wall shape by the light on both sides of it, there was that petrifying 0.1% doubt in my mind. Each time I'd thought I'd known its limits, I'd been wrong. Most shades recoiled from the mere possibility of the palest, most diffuse light. Just waving one of my flashlights in the direction of the dark zone usually caused them to scatter. But not this one. If light was pain, this enormous, aggressive shade was getting tougher, its pain threshold increasing. Like me, it was evolving. I only wished I was as dangerous. I reached inside my jacket, fisted a flashlight in each hand, and yanked the door open again. One of my flashlights wouldn't turn on. Dead batteries. When it rains, it pours. I tossed it and grabbed a second from my waistband. 2 more came out with it, crashed to the ground, clattered down the steps, and spun out into the alley, unlit, wasted. I had 2 left. This was ridiculous. I needed a better way to keep myself safe than toting unwieldy flashlights with me everywhere I went. I turned on another and ordered myself to step out onto the pavement. My feet didn't obey. I aimed one of my flashlights directly at it. The inky wall recoiled, and a hole exploded in it the exact diameter of the beam. I could see it was barely 1 inch thick. I heaved a sigh of relief. It still couldn't tolerate direct light. I studied it. I wasn't completely barred from getting to the bookstore. I could walk down to the left, parallel to the towering dark cloud, until I reached the end of the building, where the lights of the greengrocer next door prevented it from spreading further, then go around to the front door and let myself in. Problem was, I wasn't sure I had the nerve, and I wasn't entirely sure it would be smart. What if, when I was nearly to the end of the shade wall, the light on the grocer's building burned out? Normally, I'd relegate the odds of that happening to the realm of the absurd, but if there was one thing I'd learned over the past few months, it was that absurd really meant more likely to happen to Michaela Lane. I wasn't about to risk it. I had my flashlights, but I couldn't shine them on every part of my body at once, and I certainly couldn't shine them on all of it. I could call Vlaine. He'd helped me get rid of shades once before. Of course, with Vlaine, there was always a price, and I would have to let him embed his name in my tongue again. I considered my cell phone. It had 3 numbers programmed in: Barron's, IYCGM, and IYD. IYCGM, which was Barron's not-so-subtle shorthand for "If You Can't Get Me," would be answered by the mysterious Riordan, who, although Barron's contended he talked too much, hadn't confided anything useful to me in our recent brief phone conversation. I had no desire to lure anyone else close to the overly aggressive shade. I wanted a few days' reprieve between deaths on my conscience. IYD was "If You're Dying," and I wasn't. I was sick of depending on others to save me. I wanted to take care of myself. It was only a few hours until dawn. The shade could stay out there all night for all I cared. I stepped back into the garage, closed and locked the door, flipped on the brightest tier of interior lights, considered the collection a moment, then crawled into the Maybach to sleep. It occurred to me, as I drifted off, that my feelings about the car had certainly changed. I no longer cared that it had formerly belonged to the Irish mobster Rocky O'Banion, from whom I'd stolen my spear, and whom I was indirectly responsible for killing, along with 15 of his henchmen, in the very alley where the monster shade now lurked. I was just grateful it was comfortable to sleep in.
We expect evil to announce itself. Evil is supposed to adhere to certain conventions. It's supposed to cause a chill of foreboding in the intended recipient of its visit. It should be instantly recognizable, and it's supposed to be hideous. Evil should glide out of the night in a black hearse, fog streaming from its dark flanks, or dismount from a skeletal Harley, leather-clad, wearing a necklace of freshly sculpted skulls and crossbones. "Baron's Books and Baubles," I answered the phone brightly. "You want it? We've got it. And if we don't, we'll find it." I take my job very seriously. After snatching 6 hours of sleep in the garage, I'd made my way across the alley to the bookstore, showered, and opened shop, business as usual.
"I'm certain of that. You're finding it, that is, or I wouldn't have phoned."
I froze, hand on the receiver. Was this a joke? He was phoning me? Of all the possible confrontations with evil I'd imagined, this was not one of them. "Who is this?" I demanded, unable to believe it.
"You know who I am. Say it."
Though I'd heard the voice only twice before, the afternoon in the dark zone when I'd almost died, and more recently in Melusha's lair, I would never forget it. Contrary to what evil was supposed to be, it was a seductive, beautiful voice, mirroring the physical beauty of its owner. It was the voice of my sister's lover and murderer. I knew his name, and I'd die before I'd call him Lord Master. "You bastard!" I slammed down the phone with one hand and was already using my other to punch up Barron's on my cell. He answered instantly, sounding alarmed. I got right to the point. "Can the druid spell a voice be used over the telephone?"
"No. The spell's potency doesn't carry through."
"Thanks, gotta go." As I'd expected, the store phone was already ringing again. I thumbed my cell off and left Barron sputtering. I was safe from being coerced over the phone lines, and that was what I'd needed to know fast, before the Lord Master had been able to use it on me. Just in case it was a paying customer, I said, "Barron's Books."
"You should have asked me,"
came that seductive, rich voice.
"I would have told you that voice is diluted by technology. Both parties must be in physical proximity to each other. At the moment, I'm too far away."
I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of knowing that was what I'd been afraid of. I dropped the phone.
"Pretend what you will, Michaela."
"Don't address me by name," I gritted.
"What should I call you?"
"Don't."
"You have no curiosity about me?"
My hand was shaking. I was talking to my sister's murderer, the monster that was bringing all the Unseelie through his mystic dolmens and turning our world into the nightmare it was. "Sure. What's the quickest, easiest way to kill you?" He laughed.
"You have more fire than Alina. But she was clever. I underestimated her. She concealed your existence from me. She never spoke of you. I had no idea there were two with talents like hers."
We'd been equals in our ignorance. She'd concealed his existence from me, too. "How did you find out about me?"
"I'd heard rumors of another She-Seer, new to the city, with unusual abilities. I would have tracked you eventually. But the day you came to the warehouse, I smelled you. There was no mistaking your bloodline. You can sense the Shisadu, the same way Alina could."
"No, I can't," I lied.
"It's calling you. You feel it out there, getting stronger. You, however, won't get stronger. You'll weaken, Michaela. You can't handle the book. Don't even think of trying. You can't begin to imagine what you'd be dealing with."
I had a pretty fair idea. "Is that why you called me, to warn me off? I'm quaking in my boots." This conversation was wigging me out. I was on the phone with the monster that had killed my sister, the infamous Lord Master, and he wasn't cackling maniacally or threatening villainously. He hadn't come after me with an army of dark fae, backed by his black and crimson-clad personal guard. He'd phoned me, and was speaking in beautiful, cultured tones, softly, and without hostility. Was this the true face of evil? It didn't conquer, it seduced. He lets me be the woman I always wanted to be, Alina had written in her journal. Would he ask me out to dinner next? If he did, would I accept to get a chance at killing him?
What do you want most in the world, Michaela?
You dead. My cell phone rang. It was Barron's. I thumbed ignore.
That's not what you want most. You want that because of what you want most. Your sister back.
I didn't like where this was going.
I called to offer you a deal.
Deals with the devil, Barron's had recently reminded me, never went well. Still, I couldn't stop myself from asking. What?
Get me the book, and I'll get you your sister back.
My heart skipped a beat. I held the phone away from my ear and stared at the receiver, as if seeking some kind of inspiration or answer, or maybe just the courage to hang up the phone. Your sister back. The words hung in the air. Whatever I was looking for, I didn't find it. I returned the phone to my ear. The book could bring Alina back from the dead? I was chock full of superstitions inspired by childhood fables. Resurrecting the dead was always accompanied by gruesome caveats and even more gruesome results. Surely something so evil couldn't restore something so good.
Yes.
I wasn't going to ask. I wasn't. Would she be the same as she was before? Not some scary zombie? I asked.
Yes.
Why would you do that, when you're the one who killed her in the first place?
I didn't kill her.
Maybe you didn't do it yourself, but you sent them after her.
I wasn't done with her.
There was the barest hesitation.
And I had no plans to kill her when I was.
Bull. She found you out. She followed you into the dark zone one day, didn't she? She refused to help you anymore. And you killed her for it. I was certain of it. I thought about it every night before I went to sleep for months. It was the only conclusion that made sense of the voicemail message she'd left me a few hours before she died. He's coming, she'd said. I don't think he'll let me out of the country.
You felt the power of my coercion. I might have lost her willing cooperation, but I never needed it to begin with.
Imperious arrogance dripped from his voice as he reminded me how easily he'd controlled me. No, he wouldn't have needed her cooperation. With that terrible will-stealing voice, he could have made her do anything he wanted, anything at all. My cell phone rang again.
Answer it. Barron's hates waiting. Think about my offer.
How do you know Barron's? I demanded. The line was dead.
Are you all right?
Barron's growled when I answered my cell. Fine.
Was it him?
The great L.M.? I said dryly. Yes.
What did he offer you?
My sister back. Barron's didn't say anything for a long moment.
And?
I was quiet for an even longer moment. I told him I'd think about it. Silence fell between us and lengthened. Strangely, neither of us hung up. I wondered where he was, what he was doing. I strained my ears but couldn't hear any background noise. Either his cell phone had great noise reduction capabilities, or he was somewhere very quiet. An image flashed through my mind. Barron's, big and dark, naked against white silk sheets, arms folded behind his head, phone propped at his ear, crimson and black tattoos ranging across his chest, down his abs, legs tangled with some woman's. Nah, he'd never let a woman stay the night, no matter how good the sex was. Barron's, I said at last.
Miss Lane?
I need you to teach me to resist voice. I'd asked him this before, but he'd only given me one of his non-committal replies. There was another of those long silences then.
In order to attempt that. And I assure you it will be no more than an attempt, one at which I highly doubt you'll succeed. I'll have to use it on you. Are you prepared for that?
I shivered. We'll lay some basic ground rules.
You like those, don't you? Too bad. You're in my world now, and there are no basic ground rules. You'll learn how I teach you, or not at all.
You're a jackass. He laughed, and I shivered again. Can we start tonight? I'd been safe today with the Lord Master on the phone, but if instead of calling he'd strolled up behind me on the street and commanded me to be silent, I wouldn't have even been able to open my mouth long enough to release Blaine's name. I frowned. Why hadn't he walked up behind me? Why hadn't he sent his army after me? Now that I thought about it, the only two times he'd ever tried to capture me were when I'd practically delivered myself to him, and he'd believed I was alone, almost as if I'd been an opportunity too convenient to pass up. Was the Lord Master in no hurry to get close to me? Did he fear my spear after seeing what it had done to Malouche? I'd feared it intensely when I'd eaten Unseelie. I hadn't wanted it anywhere near me. But with voice, he could easily strip it away. He'd wanted Alina's willing participation, and now he seemed to want mine. Why? Because it was easier if I was willing, or was it more complicated than that? Did voice work only to a certain extent, and there was something he needed from me that he wouldn't be able to coerce? Or maybe, a chill of foreboding accompanied this thought, I was only a small part of his much larger plans, and he'd already made other arrangements for me, and it just wasn't the right time yet. Maybe he was even now constructing a cage around me that I couldn't see. Would I wake up one morning and walk straight into it? I had been duped by Malouche. I'd believed him a figment of my imagination until the last. I shoved my fearful thoughts away before they could multiply. I certainly wanted to get close to him. I was going to kill him. And his nasty trick of voice was a barrier I was going to have to be able to get past. Well, I prompted, when can we start? I didn't trust Barron's, but he'd had plenty of opportunities to use voice on me in the past and hadn't. I didn't believe he'd use it to harm me now. At least, not much. The potential gain was worth the risk.
I'll be there at 10.
He hung up. It was 9:15 by the time I finished my invention, 45 minutes before Barron's was due to arrive. I turned it on, sat back, scrutinized it a few moments, then nodded. It looked good. Well, it didn't really. It looked strange, like something out of a sci-fi movie. But it worked, and that was all that mattered to me. I was sick of not being safe in the dark. I was sick of watching my flashlights go spinning away from me. This couldn't spin away. And if I was right about its capabilities, I'd be able to walk straight through a shade wall with it on. There was one final test I needed to perform. It was a great invention, and I was proud of it. The idea had come to me this afternoon, during a slow spell. I'd been stressing over the enormous shade outside the bookstore, when suddenly a light had gone off in my head, or rather several dozen. I'd flipped the sign and locked up at 7 on the dot, raced down the street to the sporting goods store on the corner, and bought everything I needed, from the biking helmet, to batteries, to brackets and caving lights, to tubes of superglue, to Velcro bands as an added precaution. Then I'd come back to the bookstore, dialed my iPod to the latest playlist I was crazy about, cranked it up to a smidge below deafening, and gone to work. I shook my invention. I dropped it. I kicked it. And still all parts remained intact. Superglue. After duct tape, a girl's best friend. I was satisfied. With 3/4 of an hour until my voice lessons, I had time to test the device and still make it upstairs to freshen up a bit. Not that I cared how I looked around Barron's. It's just that in the Deep South, women learn at a young age that when the world is falling apart around you, it's time to take down the drapes and make a new dress. Every truly inspired invention needed a catchy name, and I had just the right one for mine. Who needed the cuff of Cruz to walk among the shades? I slipped the biking helmet on my head and strapped it securely beneath my chin. It fit snugly so it couldn't fall off in the heat of battle. I could do a flip, if I could do a flip, and the thing would stay stuck to my head. I'd superglued dozens of clicket lights all over the surface of the helmet. Brackets stuck out several inches from both sides and the rear, with spelunker lights attached, pointing downward. I swept my arms out and took a deep bow. presenting the Mac Halo. With all the lights turned on, the helmet created a perfect halo of light around my entire body, down to my feet. I loved it. If it hadn't been so bulky, I might have tried sleeping in it. As an added precaution, I strapped on the Velcro wrist and ankle bands I'd cut little pouches in and sewn clicket lights into. All I had to do was hit my wrists and ankles together, and the lights clicked on. I was ready. But first, I wanted a test run inside the store before I went outside. I clicked myself on from head to toe, hurried to the panel, and began flipping off the interior lights in the front part of the bookstore. Not the exterior ones, just the interior. Even though I knew the building was still surrounded in light outside, it was hard to make myself do it. My fear of the darkness had grown beyond a rational thing. That happens when you know a shadow can eat you alive if you touch it. My hand hesitated over the last rows of switches for a long, difficult moment. But I had my Mac Halo, and I knew it would work. If I gave fear a toehold, it would screw me. I'd learned that lesson from Barons, and had it driven home by Malouche. Hope strengthens, fear kills. I flipped off the last row, plunging the bookstore into complete darkness. I blazed as bright as a small sun in the room. I laughed. I should have thought of it before. There wasn't an inch of me, not a centimeter, that wasn't lit up. My halo radiated outward a good 10 feet in all directions, and I was right. If I had the courage, I could walk right through a shade wall. None of the vampiric life-suckers could get close to me in this get-up. My iPod began playing Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival, and I did a little dance, giddy with success. I had one more weapon in my arsenal to make me safer, and I thought of it myself. I whirled around the bookstore, miming the epic fighter I was now going to be, armed with my clever Mac Halo, no longer afraid of dark alleys in the night. I leapt chairs and darted around bookcases. I pounced sofas. I hurdled ottomans. I stabbed imaginary enemies, immune to shade danger by the brilliance of my own invention. There's not much room in my life for good, plain, stupid fun, and there hadn't been much to celebrate lately. I take advantage of both when I can. "Hope you got your things together," I sang, stabbing a pillar with my spear. Feathers exploded into the air. "Hope you are quite prepared to die." I spun in a dazzling whirl of lights, landed a killer back kick on a phantom shade, and simultaneously punched the magazine rack. "Looks like we're in for nasty weather." I took a swan dive at a short imaginary shade, lunged up at a taller one, and froze. Barron stood inside the front door, dripping cool, old-world elegance. I hadn't heard him come in over the music. He was leaning, shoulder against the wall, arms folded, watching me. "One eye is taken for an eye." I trailed off, deflating. I didn't need a mirror to know how stupid I looked. I regarded him sourly for a moment, then moved for the sound dock to turn it off. When I heard a choked sound behind me, I spun and shot him a hostile glare. He wore his usual expression of arrogance and boredom. I resumed my path for the sound dock and heard it again. This time when I turned back, the corners of his mouth were twitching. I stared at him until they stopped. I had reached the sound dock and just turned it off when he exploded. I whirled. "I didn't look that funny," I snapped. His shoulders shook. "Oh, come on, stop it." He cleared his throat and stopped laughing. Then his gaze took a quick dart upward, fixed on my blazing Mac Halo, and he lost it again. I don't know, maybe it was the bracket sticking out from the sides, or maybe I should have gotten a black bike helmet, not a hot pink one. I unfastened it and yanked it off my head. I stomped over to the door, flipped the interior lights back on, slammed him in the chest with my brilliant invention, and stomped upstairs. "You'd better have stopped laughing by the time I come back down," I shouted over my shoulder. I wasn't sure he even heard me, he was laughing so hard. Can voice make you do something that you find deeply morally objectionable? Can it override everything you believe in? I asked Barons 15 minutes later when I came back down. I'd made him wait, partly because I was still stinging from his laughter, and partly because it pissed me off in general that he was early. I like it when a man's on time. Not early. Not late. Punctual. It's one of those lost dating courtesies. Not that Barons and I are dating, but I think dating courtesies are common courtesies that should be practiced in most all civilized encounters. I pine for the days of good old-fashioned manners. I made no mention of his laughter, the Mac-Halo, or my absurd dance. Barons and I are pros at ignoring anything and everything that passes between us that might smack of emotion of any kind, even so simple a feeling as embarrassment. Sometimes I can't believe I was ever beneath that big, hard body, kissing him, getting glimpses into his life. The desert. The lonely boy. The lone man. Don't think it hadn't occurred to me that having sex with Barons might just answer some of my questions about who and what he was. It had. And I'd promptly stuffed that idea into my padlocked box, for a gazillion reasons that need no explaining.
It depends on the skill of the person employing voice, and the strength of his victim's convictions.
Typical Barons answer. Elucidate? I said dryly. I've been learning new words. I've been reading a lot lately. As I moved deeper into the room, his gaze dropped to my feet and worked its way back to my face. I was wearing faded jeans, boots, and a snug, pink, juicy T-shirt I got on sale at TJ Maxx last summer that said, "I'm a juicy girl."
"I bet you are," he murmured.
"Take off your shirt,"
he said. But this time his voice resonated with a legion of voices. It rippled outward, past me, filling the room, stuffing every corner, cramming it full of voices that were all telling me to obey, pressuring every cell in my body to comply. I wanted my shirt off, not the same way I wanted it off around Blaine, rooted in sexual compulsion, but merely because I don't know why, but I wanted it off right now, this very instant. I began to lift the hem of my tee when I thought, "Hang on a minute, I'm not going to show Barons my bra," and pulled my shirt back down. I smiled, faintly at first, then bigger, pleased with myself. I stuffed my hands in the back pockets of my jeans and gave him a cocky stare. "I think I'm going to be pretty good at this."
"Take off your shirt!"
The command hit me like a brick wall and destroyed my mind. I sucked in a violent, screeching breath and ripped my shirt from neckline to hem.
"Stop, Miss Lane."
Voice again, but not the brick wall. Rather, a command that lifted the brick wall from me, freeing me. I sank to the floor, clutching the halves of my torn T-shirt together, and dropped my head in my lap, resting my forehead against my knees. I breathed deeply for several seconds, then raised my head and looked at him. He could have coerced me like that any time. Turned me into his mindless slave. Like the Lord Master, he could have forced me to do his bidding whenever he'd wanted. But he hadn't. The next time I discovered something horrifying about him, would I say, "Yeah, but he never coerced me with voice"? Would that be the excuse I made for him then? "What are you?" It burst out before I could stop myself. I knew it was wasted breath. "Why don't you just tell me and get it over with?" I said irritably.
"One day you'll stop asking me. I think I'll like knowing you then."
"Can we leave my clothes out of the next lesson?" I groused. "I only packed for a few weeks."
"You wanted morally objectionable."
"Right." I wasn't sure his demonstration had served its purpose. I wasn't sure taking my shirt off in front of him was.
"I was illustrating degrees, Miss Lane. I believe the Lord Master has achieved the latter level of proficiency."
"Great. Well, in the future, spare my tees. I only have 3. I've been washing them out by hand, and the other 2 are dirty." BB&B didn't have a washer or dryer, and so far I'd been refusing to tote my stuff to the laundromat a few blocks down, although soon I was going to have to, because jeans didn't wash well by hand.
"Order what you need, Miss Lane. Charge it to the store account."
"Really? I can order a washer and dryer?"
You may as well hold on to the keys to the Viper, too. I'm certain there are things you need a car for.
I eyed him suspiciously. Had I lost another few months in Faerie, and this was Christmas? He bared his teeth in one of those predatory smiles.
Don't think it's because I like you. A happy employee is a productive employee, and the less time you waste going out to the laundromat or doing whatever errands it is someone like you does, is more time I can use you for my own purposes.
That made sense. Still, while it was Christmas, I had a few more items on my wish list. I want a backup generator and a security system. And I think I should have a gun, too.
Stand up.
I had no will. My legs obeyed.
Go change.
I returned wearing a peach tee with a coffee stain over the right breast.
Stand on one leg and hop.
You suck, I hissed as I hopped.
The key to resisting voice,
Barron's instructed,
is finding that place inside you no one else can touch.
You mean the She-Seer place? I said, hopping like a one-legged chicken.
No, a different place. All people have it, not just She-Seers. We're born alone, and we die alone. That place.
I don't get it.
I know. That's why you're hopping.
I hopped for hours. I wearied, but he didn't. I think Barron's could have used voice all night and never worn down. He might have kept me hopping until dawn, but at 12:45 in the morning my cell phone rang. I thought instantly of my parents, and it must have shown on my face because he released me from my thrall. I'd been hopping for so long that I actually took 2 hops toward my purse where I'd left it on the counter near the cash register before I caught myself. It was about to roll into my voicemail, a thing I've hated ever since I missed Alina's call. So I thumbed it on inside my purse, tugged it out, and clamped it to my ear.
Forth and Langley,
Inspector Jane barked. I stiffened. I'd been expecting Dad, figuring he'd just forgotten to factor in the time difference. We alternated calling each other every other day, even if only for a few minutes, and I'd forgotten last night.
It's bad. 7 dead. And the shooter's holed up in a pub, threatening to kill more hostages and himself. Sound like the kind of crime you wanted me to tell you about?
Yes. Himself, Jane had said. The shooter was a man, which meant I'd missed whatever crime the woman who'd picked it up the night I'd been watching had committed, and the book had already moved on. I wondered how many times it had changed hands since. I would search back issues of newspapers for clues. I needed all the information I could get to try to understand the dark book, in hopes of anticipating its future moves. The line went dead. He'd done what he'd promised, and no more. I stared down at my cell phone, trying to figure out how to get rid of Barron's.
Why was Jane calling you at this hour?
He said softly.
Have you been inducted as an honorary member of the Garda since they last arrested you?
I glanced over my shoulder with disbelief. He was standing at the opposite end of the room, and the volume on my phone was set to low. Maybe he'd picked up the tones of the inspector's voice from that distance, but there was no way he'd heard any of the details. Funny, I said.
What aren't you telling me, Miss Lane?
He said he thinks he might have a lead on my sister's case. It was a weak lie, but the first that came to mind. I have to go. I reached behind the counter, grabbed my backpack, tossed in my mech halo, strapped on my shoulder holster, transferred my spear from my boot to beneath my arm, then slid into a jacket and headed for the back door. I would get the Viper and drive to Forth and Langley as fast as I could. If the shooter was still at the scene, the Shisadu would be too. If the shooter was already dead by the time I got there, I'd drive up and down the streets and alleys in the immediate vicinity, ranging outward in a tight pattern, waiting for a tingle.
The fuck he did. He said Forth and Langley. 7 dead.
Why do you care? What kind of monster had ears like that? Couldn't I have gotten a half-deaf one? Scowling, I continued toward the door.
You will stop right there and tell me where you're going.
My feet stopped, independent of my will. the bastard had used voice.
"Don't do this to me," I gritted, sweat breaking out on my forehead.
I was fighting him with all I had, and weakening quickly. I wanted to tell him where I was going nearly as badly as I wanted to kill the Lord Master.
"Don't make me,"
he said in a normal voice.
"I thought we were working together, Miss Lane. I thought we were allied in a common